Hello, this is Jesse Liberty, and this is yet another podcast. Today, I'm pleased to have Jared Parsons, who is the lead of the C-sharp compiler team at Microsoft. Jared was here recently talking about C-sharp 9, and that was essentially part one of the discussion. Today, we're going to pick that up with part two. Jared, how are you?
I'm doing good. How are you doing, Jesse?
Very well, all things considered. What I've been saying is safe, healthy, and employed. All I can ask for.
That sounds like a good way of saying it.
We talked about a number of topics last time. We more or less ran out of time. You sent me a few topics that we might talk about today: top-level statements, nullable reference type improvements, and pattern matching. Can you tell me what you meant by top-level statements?
Yeah, so top-level statements. So this is a feature that we're putting into C# 9, where if you look at kind of a C# file, like if I, you know, want to just write like hello, like how much code do you have to add around that core concept? Like I just want to write console.writeline hello. But in order to do that in C# today, if you look at like kind of a very bare exe, like .NET new console app, what are you going to see? You're going to see a whole bunch of using statements. You're going to see a namespace declaration. Then you're going to see class program. Then you're going to see static void main. And finally, you're going to get to the point, like the thing that you actually wanted to do. That one line you wanted to write ends up being surrounded by, you know, 10 or so lines of just kind of serum in C#. And what top-level statements are doing is they're basically saying, like, why don't we remove the serum? Why can't I just essentially just open up a C# file and just start typing code? Why can't I just, it's essentially letting you take anything you can put in a thread body and just putting it at the top level scope of a C# program. And we think this is really attractive for a number of reasons. One, it's essentially removes a whole bunch of ceremony of C. Like C# has, you know, a background where it's object-oriented. There's a lot of kind of, you have to state a lot of information about your program. You have the classes, namespaces, functions. And that's not all. You have to do that like every single. Whereas with top-level statements, we're saying like, why don't we just kind of pull that away? Like, why don't we let people get down to the core concepts of what to do? Just let them start writing the statements that and remove that extra ceremony.
Well, I'm sorry. Are you saying that there won't be classes?
Oh, no. There are still classes, but you don't have to be bound by them. You can essentially now with top-level statements, you can essentially create a new C# file and you can just write system console write line hello world, and that is an entire C#.
Okay. What if I want to do a real program?
So that's, if you want to do, you're calling them real programs versus non-real programs. This is all C#. There's nothing special about it. This is all with top-level statements. This is now just a part of the C#. If you want to say, like, if you start with kind of these more simple programs, these top-level statements, and you ever say, like, okay, you know, I want to have a little more control. I want to go back to kind of, like, I've reached a point in my program where it's gotten complex, that all that ceremony that you used to have in a C# program has reached a point that it's value. It's going to add value to my program, have an explicit class program, to have an explicit namespace, to have control over, like, the signature of the main. All you do then is add that to your program. Simply take all of your top-level statements, cut them out, and paste them into a main method, and move on. It's not a big semantic change to go from top-level statements to explicit main. It's actually a very straightforward change. It is, frankly, just ceremony. It is taking the time to add the class program there, add the main method, and take all the code and place it in there.
Are there other methods that are going to be simplified by this?
At this time, like, yes, in that you can add, when it comes to top-level statements, you can add statements, you can add functions, you can add pretty much anything. So it basically removes all the ceremony. And when you can, like I said, you can define functions, you call them, you define variables, you can do pretty much anything you can do in a method, you could just do in a top-level statement.
Right. I'm not trying to push on this, but I don't spend a whole lot of time in main. Mm-hmm. I spend a lot of time I do a lot of mobile programming, but either way, I spend a lot of time in creating classes and designing classes and methods and having things interact with each other and make presentation of that information and so forth. Is top-level statements going to help me with any of that?
Probably not as much in its current form. In its current form, in kind of the C# 9 iteration, application, we've decided to be essentially a little pragmatic in that we're really kind of restricting it to a single file in the program that is essentially bound. We've deliberately structured it, though, so that in the future we kind of expand and we can say, allow top-level statements, you know, across any file in your program, allow it for essentially allowing you to kind of essentially define like global functions we allow.
Mm-hmm.
But we decided that for C# 9, we wanted to be a little cautious with our approach, kind of limit the feature, get some feedback on it, decide how impactful kind of adding things to the global namespace would be, and then revisit that and see. Now, when you talk, and you talk about like mobile applications, like one way we kind of envision this being done is if you look at like lots of microservices or lots of, there are an increasing number of kind of essentially what you would say are fairly small programs being written, where you have essentially a very small program, which is just combining a series of libraries into a microservice. And those we feel are dramatically simpler with global statements because it's just create a project file, add a few references, have your 10 or 12 lines of code to stitch all those services together, and off. And so, oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, it's okay. It sounds to me like this could be very useful for small demonstrations and for teaching.
Teaching is another one that I think is actually very good. So my history, like back before I worked at Microsoft on the C# compiler, was I actually was a teaching assistant in college. And recently, about 5 or 6 years ago, I actually had the opportunity to participate in this program called TEALS. And TEALS is a nationwide program where essentially computer scientists can go to high school and teach AP science. And part of the goal is to teach the kids. The other part is to teach the teachers on how to teach classes. But it was really refreshing because it was kind of the first time in a very long time where I got to interact who basically knew nothing about programming. And TEALS is actually taught in Java. But if you look at Java and kind of the simple Hello World style of programs, there's not a lot of difference between like Hello World in Java and Hello World in C#. And day one of the class is you kind of show the program. You show the students like, hey, this is Hello World. This is how you write code. And immediately like the first hand comes up. And they're like, so what is imps? Because in Java, you have instance of using. It's like, well, okay, you just always put that in your program. Don't ever think, you're never going to, that's never going to matter for this class. And then they raise their hand. They're like, well, what is system? And you're like, just always put it there. It doesn't matter. And then they're like, so what is namespace? And it's like, also doesn't matter. Don't worry about it. And then they go, so what is class? I'm like, okay, yes, classes. Classes we're going to learn about, you know, about week four. But just for now, just put it there. And they're like, okay, so why do you have the open brace? And it's like, because that's how you organize code. And it's like, so what is public? It's like, you're never going to learn that in this class. So what is static? Static, we're not going to teach in this class. What is void? And this series of questions just goes on and on with these new students. And it's because this is something fresh and new to them. They have no basis for context. And so, but they're trying to interpret the program essentially line by line. And what you find is like, there's so much ceremony there that when I did this, like the demonstration of kind of like the simplest program C, I spent all my time telling them to not look at pretty much everything on the screen. It's like, can you just focus on this like one line of code? And it's very distracting. Are not familiar with programming, someone who's new to programming. They, all of the ceremony, all of the extra words, they become a barrier to learning kind of core concepts. And we do think that top-level statements is something that will significantly help. It will be a way to kind of teach people by starting on only the core concept, letting them get the feedback they want. And then as they kind of gain skills, step back and introduce the concepts one by one to them.
Okay, I can definitely see that and value in that. I've tried to teach that class and I'm familiar with those questions, and removing all of that would be just tremendous because you can focus on the things you want to focus on and then introduce, as you say, ceremony as you go along. So that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to switch subjects on you because it's one that I'm particularly interested in, which is nullable reference types. And you suggested that there'll be changes and improvements to that.
Yes. So nullable reference types was a big, it was one of the most significant things that the C# team has done since JIX. And we understood when we released it. And one of the reasons we actually spent so much, we actually got nullable reference types. We actually started giving it to customers through Visual Studio about 5 or 6 months before we RTM'd it, because we understood that it was a feature that would not be complete until we had significant customers. Because nullable reference types at its core is, it is essentially heuristic. The goal of nullable reference types is not to eliminate 100% null references. It's to try to get 98, 99%. It's trying to find as many of the common patterns as possible and point them out to developers rather than perfect solution. And as such, we knew that in order to be successful, we need to get nullable reference types into customers so that they can put them in real code bases and give us feedback and tell us this worked, this didn't. You're missing kind of a hole. You're missing, you have a gap. And at the same time, we also knew that it was going to take a long period of time for nullable reference types to essentially be adopted by the so that it could get into the kind of the big core libraries. Those libraries could then get in the hands of customers who are also in nullable reference types, and that we could see all of the pieces kind of fitting together. We could start. And so we knew when we released C# that we were going to spend a lot of the time in C# and C# 9 essentially defining these types, essentially expanding it out, adding new features, tuning a lot of kind of the little sub how nullable gets tracked. And we have spent a lot. And a lot of that really just comes down to cleanup. We found one of the, I think, kind of the biggest sources was actually around var. So like the var. The way we designed, when we designed var in C# 8, we said, okay, like if you have like var x equals some constant string, what should be var? And we had a lot of debates around this. We said, well, if you call a function which, let's say, returns string question, should var be, you know, should var be string? Should var be string question mark? What if you say var x equals some constant string? And where we kind of landed in C#8, we said, okay, if you have var assigned a non-nullable value, then var becomes a non-type. It becomes essentially string. Whereas if var gets assigned a nullable string, then we will have that becomes string question. And that seemed like a very sensible decision at the time. Because I said, okay, we're going to take, you know, essentially if you're assigned a non-null value for a non-null, very easy. What happened though is then in practice, we spent a lot of time looking at pull requests where people were adding nullability into GitHub repos. And what we found was people were deleting var from codebase at a pretty massive rate. And the reason why was apparently it is an extremely common pattern to initialize var with a non-null value, but then later in your code, assign it something which is potentially null. And the easiest way to think about this is like linked lists. So let's say you're iterating lists. Like this is something pretty much every programmer has done. You basically say like current equals the head of the list. While current is not equal to null, check the current value, and then say current equals current next. Well, next in a linked list, if you think about kind of from a null perspective, it's always going to be node question mark because next can always be null. And what we found then was that that pattern, that kind of core concept of assigning non-null value and then kind of iterating through to get to null is extremely common. And based on the rules we've done in C# 8, that was forcing people to get rid of var. Because instead of saying var current equals head, where head was a non-nullable node, they had to say node question mark current equals head. And,
right.
And when we kind of looked at that and the impact that had on the ecosystem, we said, okay, let's take a step back here and say that that's fine. We will always infer for var. We will always infer like node question. And the reason why is that doesn't actually impact the safe program because we will still track the null values for var. And what we did was essentially shift the warning from assigning to current to where if you ever accidentally said current dot like to string or current dot some method call when you would assign null, that's when we warned and said, okay, no, you are now potentially inserting a null reference.
Right.
So that was, those were the types of changes that was basically getting community feedback, spending a lot of time kind of looking at how the community using nullability and just kind of tuning our heuristics. And we spent a lot of time in the C# compiler over the 9.0 release pushing nullability into the C# compiler. We didn't have time to do this in C# 8 because we were so busy with the feature. But in the year since we've shipped, we have annotated the majority of our public APIs, a huge chunk of our implementation, as well as kind of a good chunk of the IDE in C# has been infused with nullability. And kind of our motto now is in the C# compiler is every time you fix a bug in a file, fix the bug, commit your code, then go to the top of the file, add nullable enable, and fix all the warts. And so we've been using that as kind of a tool to put nullability to the C# compiler. And through that, we've also just found lots of little heuristics. And this includes how we refs, as well as we spent a ton of time on how we use. So attributes were kind of the bridge in nullability. So nullability is mostly the core nullability feature, essentially looking at types and data. Did you assign a null to a string bank, a normal string? Okay, well, that's a warning. That if you invoke a method call on a particular object, Has that object been assigned null? If so, issue. Attributes, though, the limitation with that approach, though, is that it means that we can only just kind of look at data, and we can only look at method signatures. It really fell down when you had methods like try value. Try get value, we need more information to know what the impact is. And that's why in C# 8, we added a bunch of attributes, like not null when true. So you can go to all your try get values, you can go to the output and say not null when the return of this method is true. And that was a big bridge for Python. It essentially allowed us to say, okay, we can say like if dictionary.tryGetValue out string, okay, in the if block, string is not null, and in the else block, string is null. Now, in C# 8, the attributes, though, we didn't have any enforcement. It was really kind of an honor system. You put the attributes on your API, and we just trusted you and said, okay, whatever they said is true, and we will believe it. In C# 9, we actually spent a lot of time enforcing the attributes. So now, if you have an attribute that says, like, not null when true, the compiler will look at every return in the body of that method and say, hey, you returned true here, but you didn't assign that value to be non-null. And so that enforcement was added for pretty much all of our apps. And what we found was our honor system was bad. We had cheated in a lot of different places inside the framework. We actually ended up finding some bugs in our annotations inside the BCL and inside Rasa as we kind of turned, we started enforcing these attributes inside the bodies.
How much of this is of concern to library creators, library designers, and how much of it is of concern to programmers who are working, I don't know what the right term is, front-end programmers or application programmers, that's what I really haven't.
I think you can kind of break it down. So people who are library authors, they're the ones who tended to be most impacted by kind of finance. And the feedback, though, was given by them. Most of this feedback was, hey, we found out that kind of the heuristics you did didn't give us the right things here, or you added this feature, but you didn't give us any enforcement, so we ended up cheating without knowing. And so the library authors tended to be impacted more because we basically started either A, loosening restrictions to make their lives easier without sacrificing anything in terms of enforcement. Like we pretty much in every case found a way to say, we can still identify the error occur, but we can reduce the places we're giving warnings that help. And in the other cases, we basically was new warnings to help them find bugs in the way that they did. And so library authors were mostly, like, they gave us very positive feedback as we kind of adjusted the rules, got the code to them, and were able to get better in the live. For the most part, end applications weren't, because the annotations the library authors producing didn't change. It just changed some of their implementations to deal with bugs. In addition to kind of the attribute enforcement, fixing the heuristics, and getting the kind of refining our warnings, we've also added two new to null the reference type. The first one is we've added a new attribute called member not. And what this attribute does is we found that there was when looking at kind of the framework code as well as a lot of our customers kept coming back to us and saying, hey, I have a lot of initializers. Like, I have a lot of methods like ensure initialized, or, you know, I have a type where if I have a node where a node, I have like a token, a type which could either be a node or a token. And if it's a node, then I know that then a particular field is non-null. And if it's a token, then I know a different field is non. So we added, in kind of looking at that, we ended up adding this new attribute called member not null. And this is something that you can add onto methods. And you can essentially say that when this method is called, after calling this method, these sets of fields and properties on my type are guaranteed not. And this allowed us to remove a whole bunch of warning suppressions within both the Roslyn base, kind of .NET framework base, as well as a lot of our customers. And this attribute, like all the other attributes added, is now both enforced on the caller and in the patient. When you have a method, hey, member not null, at the end of, if I have a method called like is node, and then on that type, I also have a property called node, and you say like member not null, we will basically enforce that, hey, if you call that method, we will assume on entry that member was null, that you must make sure it is not null. And that was one that we were able to significant numbers. The second feature we're adding is two questions. So the nullable reference type for generic code was largely attribute. We essentially had no way of saying that we have a type, and when this So this was largely done. I'm going to start with. So another one we did for C# 9 is we introduced new callbacks. So writing generic code with nullability was a bit of a pain point in C# when you were dealing with unconstrained. So when you were dealing with constrained type, for instance, said like where to class, then you could use to question all over because we understood that you represented a ref. So if you said to question, we are now doing null to ref. Whereas if you had where to struct, then to question was a nullable value. And that essentially compiles down to null. And so that is actually a different type, whereas to question a class, this is an annotation. However, when we were dealing with unconstrained, you just had, like, for instance, list of T. T question mark was ambiguous. We didn't under, it was very hard to say, like, did you mean for this to be a nullable value type or is this a nullable reference type? And so for C# 8, we decided to essentially not make things, in part because we weren't sure how big of an issue this would customers. There's a large part of us who thought, hey, all the people who are concerned about nullable value, nullable reference types, they're using less. And so we have given them sufficient features to do that. At the end of the day, though, after release C# 8, we had a lot of people uptake it, and people really got stuck in their generic code, and they thought that it was providing friction. And so for C# 9, we decided to extend nullable reference types to work with unconstrained. And the way we do this is we have a new feature called TQuestionQuestion. And TQuestionQuestion is always unambiguously, it means that, hey, if T is instantiated with reference type, then give me TQuestion. Pretend this is a null reference type. However, if this is instantiated with a value type, then don't give it any nullable. So for instance, if you had TQuestionQuestion and it was instantiated, T was instantiated with string, then the compiler at the call site would say, okay, this is a string question. It is something which potentially null. However, if you instantiate TQuestionQuestion with int, then this comes back as a simple value. There's nothing special about it, normal value. And we think that this is going to really simplify nullable reference types in generic code. We ended up in trying to annotate our own generic code, found it very difficult to get correct. And this is going to massively simplify things for us and us.
Jared, talking to you sometimes is like sucking on a fire hose, as they say. That's a lot of information.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Some of these features, some of these features get complex, and I do sometimes get stuck on my own details.
No, I like it. It's great. I really want to talk to you about pattern matching.
Awesome.
But I think that's another probably half hour, if not more, of discussion. So I'm wondering if I can impose on you for a part 3 down the road.
Sure thing. We can definitely do that.
That's great. I think folks will really like that. This was great. I want to thank you very much. This really took us into the weeds, but in a way that was very understandable and really good. And I'm looking forward to part 3.
Awesome. Thanks very much. Glad to come.
Thank you.